Welcome to the Physics 142 lecture for September 9th, 2010. You will find PDF slides on the class website to accompany this MP3 audio file. If you have been having technical issues with the slides or the audio for these lectures, please send me email so that I can see if I can help you with those issues. Workshops begin on Monday, September 13th. Not this week, the week of this lecture, the week of September 9th. Your problem set 1 is due by the morning of September 10. You'll want to place your homework in the box outside of my office door, which is Bausch & Lomb 203E. There should be a box there with a sign basically saying this is where you put your homeworks, and I'll ask the TAs to pick them up on Friday. If you have any questions concerning the lectures, material covered on the lectures, or whatever, please feel free to email me, and I'll try to answer them. Okay, so please proceed to slide 2 for the accompanying lecture notes. Last time we looked at Coulomb's law, and for the single charge, which is pictured up at the top of slide 2. Imagine that we have a point charge, big Q, and some distance away we have a point charge, little q. Then the force of big Q on little q is vector force, and it goes as k times the magnitude of q times the magnitude of little q over r squared. Actually, the charges can come with a sign, so they can be plus or minus. So in fact, we don't want to use magnitudes for the two charges. You can go ahead and use the algebraic sign. And then the direction of the force is along the r-hat vector. Now, k is a constant that sets the magnitude of the scale of the force, basically, and the numerical value for k depends on what units you choose for the charges and the distances. In this case, we're using MKS units, so we're going to use charge in coulombs and distance in meters. If the two charges, big Q and little q, have the same sign, then the overall sign of the right-hand side of the equation is positive, and the force will be repulsive. That is, the force on little q will be in the same direction as r hat, which is the unit vector along the r vector. If big Q and little q have opposite charges, then the overall force will be negative, and you'll have an attractive force on little q. If we have multiple discrete charges, then we do exactly the same thing for each of the pairs of each of the discrete charges in the distribution. So, for example, suppose we have little q, referring to the bottom sketch on slide 2. Suppose we have little q, and we decide that we want to know what is the net force on little q due to some discrete charge distribution. Then that would be the vector superposition of the force on little q due to each of the individual charges in the discrete charge distribution. So in this case, we have big Q1, which is given by a vector r1 away from q, big Q2 given by a vector r2, and then some arbitrary big Qn given by a vector r sub n, and you can have any number of discrete charges here. And then we sum up the vector forces. So in the equation on the right-hand side, the net force on little q is the sum from I equal 1 to however many charges we have of k q sub I times q over the r sub I squared, where r sub I is the distance, is the magnitude of the r sub I vector. And each of these terms in the sum has a direction given by the r sub I unit vector. And this is a vectorial sum. So this looks a bit, this looks a little bit opaque in this form, but basically in a practical example where you have a handful of charges, it just boils down to doing the vector sum carefully and you know, breaking things into components and adding them up correctly. And that's just sort of tedious work, which I hope students in this class are very comfortable with. If you're not comfortable with it, you want to get comfortable with it very fast. And in fact, I do have assigned some problems that will sort of get you back in the swing of doing vector sums, vector superpositions, if it's been a while. All right, so let's get on to slide 3. So one of the things we talked about last time, toward the end of class, was what is Coulomb's force? What does Coulomb's law look like if, in fact, we have a continuous charge distribution, so some arbitrary potato of charge? So it could be a volume. It could be that the charge is distributed on a surface. It could be that the charge is distributed in a line. And I don't mean to... So we will concern ourselves with volume charge densities, area charge densities, and linear charge densities, where that charge density basically is giving you the charge per unit volume, charge per unit area, or charge per unit length. And it may vary. Okay, it could be the problem is set up so that it's constant, or it could be that it's set up so that it's some variation. The picture that I have on slide 3 is basically some arbitrarily shaped charge distribution. And in this case, we'd like to know what is the net charge, what is the net force on little q from this big charge distribution. And the first thing we do is we break up this charge distribution into lots of little volumes, or if it were on an area, it would be lots of little areas, or if it were a line distribution, it would be lots of little short line segments. But basically, you take the charge distribution and you break it up into little differential pieces of charge. So I've signified that as a little dq in the midst of this potato of charge. And that charge piece of charge that we're considering has a particular location. I've drawn a coordinate system, and we have the point, the charge dq is located by vector r from the origin of the system. Little charge q, the point that the charge, the green charge on the left, which is what we are trying to, which is the charge on which the force is that we're trying to determine, that is located by vector r sub q from the origin. So the distance, the vector that gives the distance and direction of little q from the point charge in the distribution dq is given by the vector difference r sub q minus r, which is brown and shown basically cutting across from dq over to little q in the sketch. Okay, so now we have what we need in order to be able to answer the question as to what is the force of dq on q. It's not a net force, really, because dq is a little tiny charge. So we think of it as a differential force, df. And so if we now look at the equation, which I have numbered with a Roman numeral 1, the differential force, df, on little q due to the differential charge dq goes as k times the magnitude of one of the charges, which is q, times the magnitude of the other charge, which is little dq, over the distance from dq to q squared, which is the vector distance magnitude of it squared, times the direction of the vector going from dq to q, or the unit vector r sub q minus r. So that would be the differential force. And all we've done there is basically take the distribution, think of it as being made up of lots of little point charges, consider one of those point charges, dq, and then write down Coulomb's law for that. Having done that, we now recognize that this charge distribution is not made up of a single point charge, but it is made up of lots of these little point charges all basically added together in a continuous way. So think of it as an infinite number of these little dq's. And so in order to find the total force, we have to do the vector sum of all of these little pieces. Since we're summing up little differential pieces in the limit, that's known as an integral. So the total force net vector force on little q is equal to the integral over the volume of the charge, the total volume of the charge, whatever it happens to be, k times q times dq, but I'm going to rewrite dq as a function of the as rho dv, where rho is the charge density, and I multiply it by a differential volume dv. And rho might be a function of where you are in the potato. In other words, rho is a function of the vector r. Remember, r being the vector from the origin to dq. So that's a function that you may be given. Basically, it is that the charge distribution may vary with position, wherever it is. And one of the reasons we go to the differential limit with little dqs is because dq is so small, little dv is so small, that rho is constant across that particular little volume, which allows us to basically write Coulomb's law. So we take the expression given by the beside the green numeral 1, and we can write the expression given by the green numeral 2 when we integrate over the charge and substitute rho dv for dq. And then we actually just do the integral. And of course, that could be arbitrarily difficult, depending on how things, what the problem is. Generally, there'll be some form of symmetry or thinking that you can use to be able to do the problem. For the problems you'll see in this class, I mean, it's certainly possible to make something that's impossible to solve analytically, but anyway, so this is the basic gist. So what we have written here is Coulomb's law for continuous distribution of charge. All right, so let's go to slide 4 now. The next step is one that's fairly mental. It's sort of a game, I guess, and we talked about it a little bit last time. What is it that is that charge big Q that you see on the left here? What does it do such that if I place a little charge, test charge, little q, at point P on the right-hand side of slide 4, what is it that big Q does to the space surrounding it such that if I put a little q at point P, it feels a force? That's a very deep and profound question, and without really saying that we really understand the essence of it, let's basically play pretend. Sorry. So let us assume that big Q actually makes a change of some form in the space around it and imbues the space around it with something which we will call the electric field. And the electric field is such that at any given point P in space, there is an electric field if you place a test charge Q there that feels a force. And that electric field is the vector force divided by the magnitude of that test charge. So the electric field is in the direction that a positive little test charge will be pushed at that point in space, and its magnitude is equal to the force that that little test charge would feel divided by the magnitude of the charge. So we're dividing out in the force equation, I mean, we're dividing out the magnitude of whatever the charge is that we put at that little point in space, that little test charge. What that means is that the electric field really only depends on big Q in this case. So the electric field is a measure of what is happening in the space around big Q, independent of whatever the little test charge is that you put there. So a way to test if there's an electric field is you place a little test charge at that point, and you can actually then visualize the direction of the electric field by drawing a little arrow in the direction that that test charge would be pushed. So if big Q is positive, and we put our little positive test charge at point P, it will go in the direction of the pink arrow and the pink force that I have drawn on the sketch in slide 4. So one of the fantastic things about this, sort of twofold. One, it gets rid of that second charge so that we can talk about what a particular charge distribution does to the space around it, in a sense, creating an electric field which then can affect charges. The other step, which is a really big one and one of the wonderful reasons that we use fields in this business, is we now are talking about a characteristic out in space, and we can divorce that from the thing that actually created it. So, for example, suppose I have a big black box over the big cube. Maybe I don't know anything about that particular charge. I can still go around and put my little point charge in space and ask, is there an electric field? Because there is an electric field if that point charge fields a force, and in fact I can map out that electric field by looking at the direction and the magnitude of the force on that little test charge. So in a sense, this whole field concept allows us to talk about the effect out in space without having to worry so much about the source as well. So we're sort of going, this idea of the electric field allows us to divorce what's happening out in the space from the source. Now, of course, there's a relation in principle, but we can talk about the effect of electric fields on charges without worrying so much about how that electric field got there, for example. So it's a bit of a conceptual jump. One of the things which you're going to need to do in this class is to develop an intuition about electric fields. You're going to need to develop a way to sort of visualize them. That way you can look at problems and try to get an idea of whether things are working the way they're supposed to. So let's now go to slide 5, and let me take you through this a little bit. Let us look in the upper left-hand corner where I have a sketch that I've labeled with a blue A in a box. And in this case, we have a single point charge, a positive charge, sitting in space. And I have drawn 3 points labeled by Roman numerals. And in each case, I have drawn a blue arrow that represents the force that a little test charge would feel if it were put at the at that particular point. So in all 3 cases, the little test charge is pushed away from the positive charge in a radial direction. And note that the blue arrows at points 1 and 2 are actually longer because those are about the same distance away from the charge, so they're roughly the same length. But they are longer than the blue arrow that is emerging from point 3, and the reason for that is they're closer. So the electric field, the force per unit test charge, is going to be larger at points 1 and 2 than it is at point 3 because of the 1 over r squared scaling. I didn't do it perfectly, so of course this doesn't look like it's going as the square. I should probably have made it bigger. But you can get the idea. So if I were to take lots of points and sort of map out how this electric field would look surrounding this single positive test charge, you would get something that would look fairly similar to what we have in the right-hand top sketch where I have a blue B in a box. Basically, you have a positive charge and you have electric field lines emanating from it in a radial direction. We can look at more complicated distributions. So, for example, if we look at the bottom and we look at where I have a blue C in a box, then we can consider a number of different points. Let's start with point 3, for example. If we look at a point that's basically along the line that joins the positive and negative charges, in this case, I draw a blue arrow to represent the force of the positive charge on the test charge at point 3. And I draw a red arrow that represents the force of the negative charge on the positive test charge at point 3. So it makes sense if I put a positive test charge at the point signified by Roman numeral 3. It's going to be repelled by the positive charge and attracted by the negative charge. So the red and blue arrows both point toward the negative charge, and So there we go. If I do the same thing now for, say, point 2 up above the point 3, then in fact, point 2 is about the same distance away from the positive charge and the negative charge. But now the positive charge and the negative charge definitely are causing forces in different directions. The positive charge, again, the blue line is going to move in a radial direction away from the positive charge, while the red line will move in a radial direction toward the negative charge, because it will be attracting the positive test charge that I would put at Roman numeral 2. If I look at position 1, for example, you have a similar case where we have the red and blue vectors along radial lines with respect to the positive charge for the blue and the negative charge for the red, respectively. But now notice that since the point 1 is closer to the positive charge than it is to the negative charge, the length of the blue arrow, that force from the positive charge, is much longer than the length of the red arrow. And you have a similar thing for points 4 and 5 that I hope you can think your way through. So if we go to 5A now, the next slide actually, what I've drawn on the various points is now a pink arrow. So for example, for point 3, the pink arrow represents the vector sum of those two collinear vectors, the blue one and the red one. So you have a large net force toward the negative charge. For point 2, the up and down components of the red and blue vectors actually cancel each other out, and the only pieces that add together are the pieces that go to the right for the blue and the right for the red. And you end up, in the vector sum, you end up with the pink arrow. Similarly, if you do a vector sum of the red and blue arrows for 1, 4, and 5, you'll get something that looks like the pink arrows that I've drawn. So you can imagine now playing this game at all points in space, and if you do so, you might begin to map out sort of these lines that are tangential to the resultant net force on the test particle as you move it around from place to place. And these lines, if you map them out and sort of draw them the way that I have, are called electric lines of force. So let's go to slide 6. So here you see a few examples of electric lines of force that basically map out lines that are tangential to the electric field that you would see at any given point if were you to place a test charge at that point somewhere along one of these lines. The density of these lines is representative of the magnitude of the electric field. So the density becomes much greater as you get much closer to the point charge, the positive point charge in the sketch that's signified by the Roman numeral 1, for example. So we've looked actually already at the example Roman numeral 1, which is a single point charge, and Roman numeral 3, which is a dipole distribution. So you have a positive and negative charge separated a bit. And there's another distribution where it's signified by Roman numeral 2, where we have two positive charges. And now it should make sense, the electric field right between them is zero, because if I put a test charge directly between two similar positive test charges, they'll both be pushing it, and the net force of the two will cancel, and the force due to each of them will cancel out, and the net force is zero. So these drawings are showing you basically the lines of force, which you would like, what you'd like to be able to do in this class is for different kinds of charge distributions, you want to begin to develop a sense of how to visualize lines of force, because that's going to be your mental picture of how the electric field is. And in the end, electricity and magnetism boils down to forces on charges and currents, really, is a way to think about it. And in this case, we're just talking about charges, But a way to visualize the effect on a charge is to visualize the electric field, because that's sort of what it does. And once you begin to develop the intuition about the electric field, you get a sense of what has to happen to the charges around different things. So there are some rules about drawing these lines. Electric field lines always emanate from positive and go into negative. And the reason for this is because the lines are tangential to the electric field lines, or the force that would be felt by a positive test charge. So, of course, near a positive particle, a positive test charge will be pushed away, and near a negative, it will be attracted. The lines never cross, and there's actually some real depth to that particular statement. But a way to think about it is you cannot at any given point have the same particle pushed in two directions, because the electric field is a vector field. So you have vector superposition. You might have, for example, a discrete charge distribution where each of the other charges is pushing that test particle in different directions, but you don't really see it that way. What you see is the net sum of those, and that is what the electric field is at that point, and you have it going only in one direction. So electric field lines never cross, and the lines of force never cross. The density of the lines is proportional to the magnitude of the electric field. And by virtue of construction, the force on a particle and the electric field are always tangent to the lines of force. I would like to draw your attention at the bottom of page 6 to the URL that I have there. If you go to the class website, you can find a link to an electric field applet, and I would like you to pull it up and play with it. It basically is a very nice applet that that you can use to look at vector superposition and electric fields. You can start out with a single charge and vary the magnitude of that charge, and you can see how the field lines, which are represented on the grid, will grow in length, because the electric field gets stronger if the central charge is larger. If you now move the charge around, you'll see that the electric field lines all move accordingly, always staying radially away from that charge. You can now toggle adding in another charge or two, and you can look at the electric field lines in areas of space due to each of the charges individually, because they're color-coded, and you can look at the vector sum of all those electric field lines at each point in the grid. And so you can see, as you move the charges around, how the different components of the electric field at the point on the grid actually varies depending on what's going on with the charges, and see how the vector superposition works. So do spend some time with the applet. Make sure you're very comfortable with the basic idea and the intuition about this. You can put on multiple charges, change the magnitude of the charges, move them around, and get a sense of what's going on. Let's go to slide 7. Okay, so we have thought our way through the electric field sort of visually, conceptually. Now what I'd like to do is to get quantitative. And what I'd like to do initially is to be quantitative about the electric field that surrounds a single point charge. So it's the simplest thing we can do. So in the upper half of slide 7, imagine that we have a charge, blue large Q. And what I'd like to do is to look at the electric field that surrounds it. So let us imagine, what is the electric field at point P? If we were to place a little test charge Q there, then we could ask, what is the force on that test charge Q? Point P is given, specified, by the vector R. So if we look at the equation signified by Roman numeral 1, the force of big Q on little q, the test charge, if we place it at point P, is given by Coulomb's law, so it's kqq over r squared in the r hat direction. Remember that the electric field is the vector force divided by the test charge magnitude. So we take that same expression that we see in equation Roman numeral 1, and in Roman numeral 2, we see what the electric field is. So we take it and we divide the force by little q, and we get kq over r squared, where the q is the big Q that's left. So it's k times the magnitude of the charge. Well, it's more than magnitude. It also has a sign. So if q is positive, the force is going to be the field, and the force will be out in the radial direction. If big Q were negative, then the field and the force will both be in toward the central charge, big Q. So it's a very good thing to remember that the electric field surrounding a point charge points out radially, and it goes as kq over r squared, where q is the magnitude of that, or is the charge of that central charge. We'll have to use this all the time. We pointed out some similarities between gravitation and electrostatics last class, or in the first class, in fact. Both gravitation and electrostatics are inverse square laws. And you may recall that in gravitation, if you have two large bodies near each other in space, and let's suppose they're spherically symmetric, the distance between them, you can assume in a calculation of the gravitational attraction of one on the other that all the mass of each is concentrated at a point in the center. And you can calculate it. The same is true in electromagnetism for the same reason, because it's an inverse square law. So knowing the electric field of a point charge is very important, because if I have a symmetric diffuse charge distribution and I'm far away, it will look like a point charge. So the electric field far away will look like the field of a point charge. So that's a really important and good thing to know, which is why I am circling it in red as we speak. Okay, so just like we've done with Coulomb force, the next step, the next more complicated thing, would be to ask, what is the electric field at a point P due to a discrete charge distribution? So in this case, I have a charge distribution, Q1 and Q2 up to Qn, and point P is out in space, and if I ask how is it situated relative to Q1, well, point P is a vector R1 away from Q1, and it is a vector R2 away from Q2, and it is a vector Rn away from Qn. And now I can, we already know that we know how to write the force on a test charge Q, little q, if I put it at point P, and that's basically using the Coulomb's law that we've already seen, where the force, the net force on little charge Q, is equal to a vector sum of the K times the Q sub I's times little q over R sub I squared in the R hat direction, vector sum over all the R hat, all over all of these pieces. So that's shown by the Roman numeral 3 equation. So if we take that and we divide out the magnitude of the test charge at point P, we get an expression for the electric field given by the Roman numeral 4 equation. So the electric field at P is equal to kq sub I over R sub I times R sub I hat. So basically, it's exactly the expression we have for Coulomb's law, except we've divided out the little q. And again, it is a vector equation. So if you were to draw the electric field vectors at point P due to each of those discrete charges and then vectorially sum them, you would have the electric field vector at point P as a whole. So let's now go to slide 8. This step, now what I'd like to do is to look at the electric field for a general charge distribution. Again, this charge distribution might be some arbitrary potato, some volume, you know, like a big spherical volume or a cylindrical volume, typically. Or it could be a surface, like on the surface of a ball or a table, or it could be along a line. So those are the three sort of general types of symmetries, shapes that we use in this business. You're going to hear the word symmetry a lot in Physics 142, and there will be instances where you can look at a problem and look at the symmetry and write down very important things about the problem, and your argument is by symmetry, boom, boom, is true, okay? We'll come back to that a lot as it becomes important in the class, but I just thought I'd throw it out there for right now. At any rate, by now the sketch on page 8 is beginning to look familiar. We have an origin, and relative to that origin, we have some potato of charge, which I have labeled rho sub r, meaning that it is some distribution of charge with a charge density that is a function of vector r that is out there. We have a point P, which is specified by little vector r sub p. And then we have a vector, so I pick a particular dq, a little differential charge, that is somewhere in this distribution of charge specified by rho sub r. And in particular, we'll choose a very particular r vector, which is where this dq happens to be within this potato of charge. And we will define the r prime vector to be the difference vector between the vector going to dq and the vector going to point p. And that r prime vector really represents the vector that goes from dq, wherever dq happens to be in that charge distribution, all the way to point p. So, if we have a point charge dq that is a vector r prime away from point P, then we know how to write an expression for the electric field. But because dq is not really a charge, it's this little differential charge, okay, we can't really say we have the full electric field at point P. What we're going to look at is just the differential electric field at point P due to this little dq. So if you look at the equation that is shown by Roman numeral 1, we have an expression of the differential electric field at point P due to dq, which, recall from slide 7, the electric field of a point charge goes as kq over r squared in the r hat direction. We will now write that down, but instead of q, we have dq, because that's the charge we're dealing with. So the differential electric field E at point P is equal to K dq over r prime squared in the r prime hat direction. Now, just like we've already done in the past, this charge distribution is made up of more than this one little differential charge. In fact, it's made up of an infinite number of these little differential charges, and we have to integrate around the distribution in order to see the total effect at point P. So the electric field at point P is an integral over the full charge distribution of the differential electric fields of each of the little dqs, or it's the integral over dEP. And we now substitute in for what dEP is. It's k dq over r prime squared in the r prime hat direction. And now we, on the right-hand side of the equation circled in red, we substitute rho dv for dq because it's really hard to integrate over charge per se. Usually what you have is a mathematical expression that gives you how the charge density varies with position, and then you integrate over the volume or the shape of the charge, whatever it is. So that is the general expression for the electric field for a charge distribution at the bottom of page 8. So if I were you, I would probably be falling asleep, probably for a number of reasons. One, because I can't crack jokes while I'm sitting in my office lecturing to myself. That's just not much fun. The other reason is, this is all sort of theoretical at this moment, right? I mean, it's really hard to get your head around a bunch of dqs and rhos and dvs, I think. And it's really much better to actually get the hang of this by doing an example. So that's what I'd like to do next. So let's go to slide 9, and I'll show you how to do this type of problem. So on slide 9, refer to a sketch which is on the upper left of the slide, signified by the A in a square box. What I'd like to do is to imagine that we have a line of charge. So I've taken some charge and I have spread it uniformly in a line along the x-axis from position minus L to position L, symmetrically about the origin. Okay? And I'm now going to ask, what is the electric field a distance z above the midpoint of that line segment of charge? So the line segment is 2L long, and it carries a uniform charge of lambda. Now remember, you've got to pull out your little decoder rings. This is a line problem. So for line problems, we use the symbol lambda to represent the charge density. If it were an area problem, so if this were a plane or something, and the charge were distributed evenly along the plane, I would have used a sigma. And if it were a volume, like a sphere of charge or something like that, I would use rho. Okay, so the symbol that's chosen can sometimes clear up confusion as to whether it's really a volume charge, whether the charge is distributed on a volume or on a surface or something. In this case, it's a line. And, you're just going to have to remember that here I mean line charge and I don't mean wavelength. Even though the symbols we use are the same, we're just going to maintain this strategy of trying to reuse symbols as often as possible to maintain the ultimate confusion and provide jobs for all of us for many years to come. So that's the deal. Okay, so I hope the problem is clear. I want to find the electric field at point P in a midpoint, which is at a distance z above the midpoint of a line charge, where the charge is distributed uniformly. So generally in this type of problem, I will think of this charge as being positive just because. So it's not really specified. It's just if we determine the electric field magnitude and direction, if it's positive charge, the electric field will be in equal magnitude opposite direction if it happened to be negative charge on the line instead of positive charge. So it's generically I tend to work with positive charge for thinking my way through these problems where it's not specified. At any rate, so now I have basically reproduced the picture in on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, in the region represented by the B in a brown box. So in this case, though, what I would like to do is to consider the effect at little point P, which is at the midpoint of the line. I want to consider what is the nature of the force at little point P, and if I were to place a little test charge there, of a differential charge. So on the line of charge down beneath point P, which is at a distance z above the midpoint of that line, I have drawn two differential charges dQ. And remember, because we are given the line charge density, dQ goes as lambda dL, where dL is sort of a differential length along the line itself. So that's how we'll end up integrating in the variable dL. But right now I want to think about differential charges because I want to mentally map out what's going on with this problem and what the symmetry of the problem is. So let us imagine that we have the little dq. Let's just consider the dq that I have on the left-hand part of the line down in the sketch in the lower right part of page 9. The little dq, think of it as a little positive point charge, is going to exert on a little test charge q, which is placed at point P, a force that is in the direction of the red arrow that is sort of moving along the radial line from DQ. So I have labeled that with a little arrow pointed to by an A in a circle. That little A in a circle and the little arrow coming from it in the pink points to the red line, which is the direction and magnitude of the force that little dq on the left-hand side of the line charge would put on the little test charge at point P. Then you see two other red lines. Those represent the components of the force on the test charge at point P due to dq on the left-hand side. And those components are taken along the line perpendicular to the line charge and along the line that is parallel to the line charge. So the little the pink A in a circle points to the vector sum of those two other components, basically. And then I will do a similar thing for the right-hand DQ, except I'll use blue arrows. So in this case, the lower part of the triangle of blue arrows is the resultant force on a little charge Q, test charge, placed at point P due to the DQ, which I show on the right-hand side of the charge distribution. And then the other two little blue arrows are the components of that force perpendicular to and parallel to the x-axis. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is to picture the fact that the components of the two force vectors due to these DQs that are perpendicular to the x-axis add together, while those components that are along the x-axis direction actually cancel out one another. So I have the word cancel with two lines going to the two little vector components that actually cancel each other out because they're pointing in opposite directions. Wow, so that's complicated to do if I don't have a laser pointer, which I can just lead you through this. Sorry about that. Basically, what I want to say, if you look at this problem and you place a little test charge at point P, what you'll notice is that for any differential charge that I pick along the line charge, by mirror symmetry, there is another one on the other side of the line charge such that the parallel components, the components parallel to the x-axis, will cancel out, and you're left only with the piece of the force which is pointed perpendicular to the x-axis. So by symmetry, we don't need to worry about those parallel components. We only need to worry about the transverse component. So now I would like to take you to slide 10. And now I am drawing again our problem. We have the line charge going from minus L to L of DQs, and the DQ it goes as lambda dx. I called it lambda dl a moment ago, but of course we're actually going to integrate in the variable x, so sorry for the slip there. So we will define some arbitrary dq along this line charge at some arbitrary position given by position x along the x-axis. Remember, the origin is at the center of this line, so we have defined a position x to be the distance of dq from the midpoint of the line. Once we have this dq, it is a vector r from point P, which is up above a z distance above the midpoint of the line segment. I have drawn a little differential dep, so differential electric field, which is the electric field at blue point P due to the DQ down on the line charge. What's important is to note that because of the symmetry of the problem, the component of the electric field, the component of DEP, which we have to consider is only that component which is perpendicular to the x-axis. Because remember, in the component of DEP which is parallel to the x-axis is going to get canceled by the electric field component of some other DQ on the other side of the line by the symmetry of the problem. So now that I'm starting to put real variables on the problems, I have DQ, which is some distance x from the origin, and I have vector r, and I have z, I have actually defined an angle, okay, which I have drawn on the sketch, angle theta, which is the opening angle between the vector r and the z, basically the opening angle between the line joining P and DQ and the line that is the z-axis, which bisects the line charge and goes up through point P. So by similar triangles, theta is also the opening angle between DEP and the z-axis, and cosine theta times DEP is going to be the projected piece of the DEP vector on the z-axis, and that's the piece of the electric field which is not canceled by DQs on the other side of the line charge. So that's the only piece we have to consider. So I call it the important part. So the piece of the electric field of DQ that we need to keep in the problem, that we have to consider once we've thought of the symmetry, is DEP, the magnitude of the electric field at point P due to little dq, times cosine theta, and we know the direction of it because that piece of it is in along the z direction. What is cosine theta? Well, cosine theta is, by the construction of the triangle, remember that cosine theta is opposite over hypotenuse, and in terms of distance, and I'm sorry, not opposite, it's adjacent over hypotenuse, and the if we look at our triangle where I've defined theta in the drawing, the opposite over hypotenuse is going to be z over the magnitude of vector r. And so the piece of the electric field we need to be considering is going to be DEP times z over the magnitude of r in the z hat direction. Wow, this is not the best lecture to be trying to do remotely. Sorry about that, but I hope you're able to follow me. Okay, so now we have sort of analyzed the symmetry of the problem and converted into variables which we might be able to do something with for the little dq and its effect on a charge at point P, or the electric field at point P due to that little dq. Now what I'd like to do is to integrate over all the little dq's in this full charge distribution, which really is just this line charge. So the total electric field at point P is going to be k dq over r squared r hat, because that's how we get our electric field. That's the general equation for the electric field that we have at the bottom of page 8, for example. But now we want to put it in this actual geometry. So the way to do that is I want to integrate from 0 out to L, and by symmetry I will just now multiply that by a factor of 2, because I'm just going to be considering the component in the z direction, because by symmetry we know the component in the x direction cancels out. And so that's where the factor of 2 comes in. What I'm looking at is the equation where I have a Roman numeral 2. So the electric field at point P is a factor of 2. The factor of 2 comes from the fact that I'm not integrating from minus L to L, but I'm integrating from 0 to L and just doubling it. K dq, but dq I'll turn into lambda dx, times over r squared, and then I only want the cosine theta component, because that's the only piece that survives, and this will be in the z hat direction, because that's the only piece that survives. Okay, now I want to convert the pieces of this into something that I can integrate. So I don't really want to integrate over the angle. I really want to integrate along the chart. So I want to convert things into X's and Z's because Z is fixed and X is something that I'm integrating over. So R is, the magnitude of R is the square root of X squared plus Z squared. So I have that written where we have the Roman numeral 3. Roman numeral 4, cosine theta is going to be equal to Z divided by the magnitude of R, as we've already seen. Well, the magnitude of R is going to be the square root of X squared plus Z squared. So R and cosine theta are things that change as I move down, up and down X, but I want to integrate over X, so I have to convert them into X, basically. So we finally get equation 5, where the electric field is equal to 2 times the integral from 0 to L of k times lambda, and now we take the k times lambda times dx, and then cosine theta over r squared becomes z over x squared plus z squared piece is the r squared, and then the x squared plus z squared to the 1/2 power really is the cosine theta piece. So z over the x squared plus z squared to the 1/2 power is cosine theta, and k lambda over x squared plus z squared is times dx is basically the kq over r squared piece. And I know the electric field by symmetry has to be in the z hat direction. So because E is a vector, I have to put the direction in, and that's what the z hat is. So let's go to slide 11. Now we've got an integral that we can do. I combine the two x squared plus z squared terms on the bottom, so we actually have x squared plus z squared to the 3/2 in equation 1. I can pull out k. Lambda in this particular problem is constant. It didn't have to be. It could have been a function of x, but it's not. In this case, I said the charge was spread uniformly, so lambda is a constant. Z is a constant in this problem. So I can pull k, lambda, and z out of the integral. So if we look at equation 5 at the bottom of page 10, I pull the k, lambda, and z out, and I get, and that's what I'm doing at the top of page 11. Then I combine the x squared plus z squared terms, so I have x squared plus z squared to the 3/2 down at the bottom, and I'm left with this integral, which is in the z hat direction. The electric field's in the z-hat direction, so I've left the direction in there. I guess I could have pulled that out, too. Doesn't need to be inside the integral. Anyway, the integral that we now have to do is from 0 to L, the integral of dx over the square, over the 3, over x squared plus z squared quantity to the 3/2 power. And if you're anything like me, you look at that and go, oh, God, I don't remember how to integrate that. You know, you've had calculus. You may find many integrals that are quite easy to do in this class, and I have no problem if you do them. I also have no problem if you look integrals up, because this isn't a math class. So what's really important to me is that you understand the symmetry of the problems and you set things up properly. It is important that we be able to solve it, because one of the things that you want to do is to figure out when you know whether you're right or not. And in order to really get that, you have to solve it. Anyway, in this case, if you look up the integral of dx over x squared plus z squared quantity to the 3/2, where z squared is a constant, you get what I've written in the parentheses of equation 2. And we want to evaluate that between the limits of 0 and L. So in equation 3, I will write that. If we evaluate the quantity in parentheses of equation 2 at the limits of 0 and L, basically substituting in for x, so remember this would be x, this would be L over x squared times L squared plus z squared quantity to the 1/2 power minus 0 over z squared blah blah blah. That second term is zero, so we're only left with the first term. So that means what we have down at the bottom of page 3, we've actually evaluated the integral and evaluated at the limits 0 and L, and we're left with what we have on on equation 3. So we have the constant piece, the 2k lambda z, and it is multiplied by L over z squared times the quantity L squared plus z squared to the 1/2 power, and it's in the z hat direction. So if I clean that up a little bit and I cancel the z, one of the z in the numerator with one of the z's in the denominator, then I have the expression on the right-hand side of equation 3 on page 11. So now you go, wow, I'm done. Time to get some iced tea or whatever. Actually, you're not done yet. And this is a very, very important lesson. How do you know you're right? You have to figure out whether you're right or not. And the way in which you can figure out you're right, there are really two things that I want you to do. And I want you to get in the habit of always checking these things in problems where it is feasible to do so. Because you have it within your grasp, the ability to figure out whether you're right or not. I mean, I can't look at this crazy expression and know whether it's right or not, just offhand. I have to think about it. So, first of all, you've gone through a lot of math, and one of the easiest ways to check yourself to see that everything went right is to make sure that if you're calling the quantity on the right-hand side of this equation an electric field, then it better have the same units as an electric field. An electric field, remember, is defined as the force per unit charge on a test charge, and so the units of that will be newtons per coulomb. So the right-hand side better have units of newtons per coulomb. So in order to figure that out, remember that the units of K, let's see, is in newtons per coulomb squared times meters squared. So a newton meter squared divided by coulomb squared. And lambda has units of coulombs per meter. L has units of meter. And you can now put in all of these units and do some cancellations and find that the units that we have for the expression on the right of equation 3, in fact, is in newtons per coulomb. So you should actually go through that exercise and make sure you're happy with that. So check mark 1 is that, in fact, we have done, we've checked the units. We actually don't call it checking the units. We have to use a different phrase because we want it to sound more sophisticated. So we call it dimensional analysis. So we do dimensional analysis and we find out that, in fact, what we think is an electric field does have units of newtons per coulomb, and so that's really good. So now let's go to slide 12. And I want you to look at equation 3 on slide 11 and think about what we're doing on slide 12. I want to do what I call looking at limiting cases. Limiting cases means you take some complex problem and expression and you think of a scenario within that problem where you sort of must know the answer. And the idea is you take a charge or a distance or something and you let it go to infinity or to zero and you ask, does the answer make sense? So that's what I mean by limiting cases. So in this case, for example, suppose z becomes infinite. That is, we move very, very far away from this finite line segment. What should the answer be? Well, we know what the answer should be, because as you move very, very far away from this finite line segment, it's going to look like a point. So the electric field very far away better look like the electric field of a point charge with the total charge that one has on that complete line charge. So let's look at the expression in the middle of page 11, and now let us go to the limit where z goes infinite. If z goes infinite, you've got a problem because you basically have something finite over something that goes to infinity. So you have to use L'Hopital's rule. So the way to use L'Hopital is to take the derivative of the top and the derivative of the bottom and look at what happens as z goes to infinity. Sorry, I'm looking because I think I made a mistake on In fact, I think we probably want to do L'Hopital on the left hand, the middle term in equation 3 on page 11. I'm not going to take the time right now to check myself, but if you take that middle expression, now you take the derivative of the top, you'll get 2k lambda L. And remember that lambda times total distance times 2 times L is just going to be q, so that's equal to k times q. And then at the bottom, you have to take the derivative of that and then look at what happens as z goes to infinity. And I convinced myself at some point, although you might want to play with it right now, that it goes as z squared. So the electric field in this case will go as q over z squared, which is the behavior of a point charge. So this one's a little involved because you have to pull out the L'Hopital rule. Somewhat more straightforward one is if we take our equation 3 on page 11 and we allow L to go to infinity, that is, we let the line charge become very long. So now we're asking, what is the electric field at distance z outside of a line charge? And although we have not evaluated it, we will before long learn to evaluate the electric field for an infinite line charge using a very simple technique of symmetry. And when we do, we'll find that, in fact, the as L goes to infinity, we get 2 lambda k over z is the correct answer. So although we haven't proven that in this class yet, that does turn out to be the right answer. So in this case, although both are a little bit involved, there are two limiting cases that we can check, and in fact, in both cases, it turns out to be what we would expect. And so it turns out that the answer that we have on page 11 is correct. So as you get more of an intuition and some tools to deal with some of these simple shapes and distributions, the power of limiting cases will be something you should always try to take advantage of. And you really need to get in the habit of not just turning it into some calculus problem and following through and finding some answer and thinking you're done. In the end, your answer better make physical sense. So you want to think your way through that, because it's not always easy to just look at the answer and sort of know that it's making physical sense. You need to think about, under what scenario in this problem would I be able to calculate something where I would know that it's correct, and can I verify that in that limit my answer that I have for this problem agrees with that. So that's a very important skill to develop, and in fact, it goes beyond this class, okay? If you become a professional physicist, if you're working on your PhD or you're doing real work out in the world, plugging together all the devices and getting some data out, or doing a Monte Carlo calculation and getting an answer, or doing a theoretical calculation and coming up with some equation, that's all the easy part. The hard part is, how do you convince yourself that what you've done actually makes sense, that it actually works? And how can you then defend what you've done to other people? And that really is the serious skill that is involved in doing science, actually. It's more than just getting at an answer. It is getting at an answer that you can rely on and defend. and that's the trick. So I think I will end this lecture on that point, and I hope that it hasn't been too painful for you. I promise you I will try to be very entertaining when I return, and I hope you have a good day or night, whatever it is for you. Bye.